All right, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling something that feels super relevant to, everyone, economics. But not just dry theory. We're going deep into how economic forces shape real-world decisions with some surprising examples along the way.
It's fascinating how often we get caught up in the immediate impact of a policy, the feel-good stage one, without really considering the long-term consequences.
Okay, so let's dive right into a real-world example. You know how everyone's always talking about the California energy crisis back in 2001? What happened there? Was it really just about capping electricity prices?
Well, capping prices was certainly a major factor. On the surface, it seemed like a great way to protect consumers from rising energy costs. But what a lot of people miss was the fact that the cost of producing electricity didn't just vanish. Reduced rainfall meant less hydroelectric power and fuel costs were skyrocketing. So when the government capped prices, energy providers couldn't cover their costs.
So it was like trying to hold back a flood with a Band-Aid.
Exactly. It created a huge problem. Energy companies started going bankrupt because they were selling electricity at a loss. Investment in new power plants completely dried up because who's going to invest in an industry where you can't make a profit? And the result, rolling blackouts became the norm in California.
Wow, so it really was a case of good intentions leading to disastrous outcomes. It makes you realize how important it is to think things through carefully, not just focus on the immediate impact.
Absolutely. It all comes back to understanding incentives. Economics isn't about morality. It's about understanding how people respond to the incentives and constraints they face in the real world.
So it's not necessarily about people being greedy, but about making choices based on what makes sense for them in a given situation.
Precisely. We all make decisions based on what we perceive to be the best option for ourselves and our families. And those decisions are influenced by a complex web of incentives and constraints, not just by some abstract sense of fairness or morality.
Which leads us to the age-old debate. Central planning versus free markets. We have some pretty wild historical examples of how these two systems have played out, right?
We do. And it's always interesting to see how the theory clashes with reality. For example, you might think that having a central authority like the government calling all the shots would lead to greater efficiency and fairness.
Yeah, it sounds kind of appealing in theory, right?
Yeah.
Having a group of experts making sure everything runs smoothly and everyone's needs are met.
Right. It sounds like a recipe for utopia. But in practice, it rarely works out that way. Take the kibbutzim in Israel, for instance. These were communal settlements where everything was shared and money was basically abolished. Mm-hmm. The idea was to create a society based on equality and cooperation.
So what were the unexpected challenges the kibbutzim faced in resource allocation?
Well, without a price system to signal scarcity, resources were often misallocated. For example, since electricity was free, people would leave their lights on all day, and since meals were communal, members would often invite guests, straining the kibbutz's limited food supplies.
It's fascinating how, even with the best intention, things can go awry when you try to ignore basic economic principles.
Exactly. And this issue of resource allocation is magnified when you look at larger scale attempts at central planning like the Soviet Union. They had this massive centrally planned economy, and it was notorious for shortages, long lines, shoddy goods, and a thriving black market.
So even a powerful government couldn't manage the complexities of a vast economy through central planning.
Not effectively. No, it's just too difficult to gather and process all the information needed to make efficient decisions in a centralized system. In contrast, we see how even communist China recognized the power of free markets when they started experimenting with them in certain regions.
And what happened?
The results were astounding. Those regions experienced explosive economic growth, far outpacing other parts of the country that remained under strict government control. It was a stark demonstration of how freeing up markets can unleash incredible economic potential.
So even China, a communist country, realized they couldn't ignore the power of free markets. It makes you wonder why some countries still cling to centralized systems. But let's zoom in a bit. We've been talking about big systems, but how do these economic forces play out at the individual level?
That's a great point. When it comes to individual success, one of the most crucial concepts is human capital.
Human capital. What exactly does that mean?
Human capital refers to the skills, knowledge, and experience that individuals acquire throughout their lives. Think of it as an investment in yourself. The more you learn, develop your skills, the more valuable you become in the job market.
So it's not just about working hard. It's also about working smart and strategically.
Exactly. A great example of this is the story of Paul Williams, a black architect who dreamed of designing buildings. He was offered a paying job as a draftsman, which was a good opportunity at the time, but he turned it down. Instead, he chose to work as an unpaid office boy at a prestigious architectural firm.
Why would he do that?
Because he understood the value of human capital. He knew that the experience and connections he would gain at that firm would be far more valuable in the long run than the immediate paycheck he would have earned as a draftsman.
And was he right?
Absolutely. Paul Williams went on to have a remarkable career designing everything from mansions for Hollywood stars to airport terminals. He was a visionary architect who understood the importance of investing in himself.
It's an inspiring story, but it also highlights the importance of having the freedom to make those kinds of choices. What about people who don't have those opportunities? What about those who are stuck in low-paying jobs, struggling just to make ends meet?
That's where things get really complicated and where well-intentioned policies can sometimes have unintended negative consequences.
Like minimum wage laws. I know they're a hotly debated topic.
They are. Some argue that minimum wage laws are essential to protect workers from exploitation, while others claim they actually hurt the very people they're supposed to help.
So what's the economic perspective on this?
Well, on one hand, minimum wage laws can force some businesses to pay their employees more, which sounds like a good thing. But on the other hand, those businesses might also react by cutting back on their workforce, automating jobs, or even shutting down entirely. And if that happens, those workers are left with no job at all.
And wouldn't it be the least skilled workers, those just starting out, who would be hit the hardest?
Exactly. They're the ones who are most likely to lose their jobs or miss out on opportunities to gain valuable experience and move up the economic ladder. It's a real dilemma trying to balance the need to protect workers with the need to create a thriving economy where jobs are plentiful.
It sounds like there are no easy answers when it comes to economics and public policy.
There rarely are. It's all about understanding the complex interplay of incentives, constraints, and trade-offs. There's no magic bullet, and every decision has consequences, even if they're not immediately apparent. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Before the break, we were discussing the unintended consequences of well-intentioned policies. That leads us perfectly into a discussion about a seemingly simple topic, recycling.
Recycling? How does that fit into the bigger picture of economics and unintended consequences?
It might seem mundane, but recycling is a perfect example of how costs and benefits can play out in unexpected ways. For example, in mid-20th century, Africa, Westerners often criticized Africans for reusing containers like cigarette tins and salt bags. They saw it as a sign of poverty and backwardness.
They thought Africans should just buy new containers instead of reusing old ones.
Exactly. But what they failed to consider was the economic context. These Africans were actually being very efficient with their resources. They had an abundance of labor, especially women and children, who had limited job opportunities.
So for them, spending time cleaning and repurposing containers was a more efficient use of their resources than buying new ones.
Precisely. It was a way of maximizing the use of their available resources. And from a societal perspective, it was a smart way to conserve scarce capital.
It's a great example of how what might seem wasteful to one person can be incredibly resourceful to another, depending on the economic context.
It is, and it shows how important it is to understand the local conditions before making judgments about what's efficient or wasteful. Now fast forward to late 20th century America, where recycling became a huge movement driven by environmental concerns.
Right. Everyone was sorting their trash and feeling good about saving the planet.
Exactly. And it was certainly well-intentioned. But here's where the economics get interesting. Studies of government-imposed recycling programs in the U.S. found that the cost of collecting and processing these recycled materials often exceeded the value of the materials themselves.
So in some cases, it was actually more expensive to recycle than to just dispose of the trash.
Yes, which isn't to say that recycling is never a good idea, but it has to be done in a way that makes economic sense. Sometimes the best way to encourage recycling is to let market forces do their work.
So if there's a real demand for recycled materials, companies will find a way to make it profitable to collect and process them.
Exactly, and that's often more efficient than having the government mandate it. It's similar to how we talked about central planning versus free markets earlier. When individuals and businesses are free to respond to your incentives, they often find creative solutions that benefit everyone.
This reminds me of that classic example of how London and New York City managed to feed millions of people every day without any central planner directing the process.
That's a great analogy. Think about the sheer variety of fresh produce, meats, and packaged goods available in those cities. It's mind-boggling how all of that food arrives on time without any major shortages or disruptions, and it's all coordinated through a decentralized system of markets and prices.
It's a symphony of supply and demand with no conductor.
Precisely. And it works because of the price system. When the demand for a particular good goes up, the price rises, signaling to suppliers to bring more of that good to market. And when the supply exceeds demand, prices fall, encouraging consumers to buy more.
It's a self-regulating system that's constantly adjusting to changing conditions. And it's far more efficient than any central planner could ever hope to be.
It is. And it highlights the power of free markets to coordinate complex activities in a way that benefits everyone.
This is all fascinating, but let's be honest. Not everyone wins in a free market system. Some people are more successful than others, and sometimes that success comes at the expense of others. What about issues like crime and even slavery? Are those just inevitable outcomes of a system that rewards self-interest?
Those are tough questions. And it's important to remember that economics is a tool for understanding how the world works, not for making moral judgments. When we talk about crime, for instance, economics can help us understand the incentives that lead people to engage in criminal activity.
So instead of just labeling criminals as bad people, we can try to understand the economic factors that might be contributing to their choices.
Exactly. For example, if you're struggling to make ends meet and you see someone else getting rich through illegal means, it might seem like a tempting path.
Especially if the potential rewards seem to outweigh the risks of getting caught.
Right, and that's why we often see crime rates fluctuate based on factors like law enforcement, the severity of punishments, and economic opportunity. For instance, burglary rates tend to be higher in places where fewer people own guns.
Because potential burglars are less worried about encountering an armed homeowner.
That's one possible explanation. We also know that crime rates in general went up in the U.S. in the 1960s following a series of legal reforms that made it less likely for criminals to be caught and punished.
So it's not just about poverty or lack of opportunity. It's also about the incentives and disincentives created by the legal and economic environment.
Exactly. And it shows how even well-intentioned reforms can have unintended consequences if we don't carefully consider how they might alter people's behavior.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about something like slavery? Surely that can't be explained away by economic incentives.
Slavery is a horrific institution, and there's no justification for it. But from a purely economic perspective, we can analyze the factors that made it profitable in certain times and places.
Like the demand for cheap labor in agricultural economies.
That was certainly a major factor. In the Americas, for example, the plantation system relied heavily on slave labor to produce crops like sugar and cotton, and the cost of transporting slaves from Africa was relatively low compared to the profits they generated for plantation owners.
So in a twisted way, it was a matter of supply and demand.
Yes, but it's crucial to remember that even within the horrific system of slavery, there were variations in how slaves were treated. For example, slaves who worked in jobs requiring skill and discretion, like dyables in the Carolina swamps or those who processed tobacco, were often given more autonomy and better treatment.
Because their skills are more valuable, and it wouldn't have been profitable to mistreat them or risk them escaping.
Exactly. And there are even historical examples of slaves being put in positions of authority, like the slave who became captain of a riverboat overseeing both black and white sailors.
Wow, that's incredible. It shows how even in the most depraved system, economic incentives still play a role. But it's important to remember that this doesn't in any way justify or excuse the institution of slavery.
Absolutely. It simply helps us understand how economics can shed light on even the darkest chapters of human history. But let's move on to a slightly less heavy topic. What do you think about when you hear the term moral hazard?
To be honest, I'm not entirely sure what that means. It sounds a bit like an ethical dilemma or something.
It's definitely an important concept in economics, and it relates to the incentives that are created when people aren't fully responsible for the costs of their actions. Think about it this way. If you have insurance that covers the cost of replacing your phone if it's lost or stolen, you might be less careful with it than if you knew you'd have to pay for a new one out of pocket.
Ah, I see. So the insurance creates a moral hazard by reducing my incentive to be careful with my phone.
Exactly. And this same principle applies in many other areas, including healthcare.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this all connects. So tell me more about how moral hazard plays out in healthcare.
Well, in many healthcare systems, the person receiving medical care isn't always the one paying for it directly. Insurance companies or governments often foot the bill.
Right. So if I know my insurance will cover the cost of a doctor's visit, I might be more likely to go, even if I just have a minor sniffle.
Precisely. And doctors, knowing that patients aren't directly responsible for the costs, might be more inclined to order unnecessary tests or procedures.
But wouldn't that drive up healthcare costs for everyone in the long run?
It can take France, for example. They have a national healthcare system where most medical care is free at the point of service.
That sounds pretty good, at least from the patient's perspective.
Yeah.
What's the downside?
Well, because patients don't have to pay much out of pocket, they tend to overuse medical services. And doctors, fearing they'll lose patients if they don't provide every test and treatment imaginable, often overprescribe.
It's a vicious cycle. Patients demand more, doctors provide more, and the costs just keep rising.
Exactly. And this can lead to longer wait times for appointments and procedures, as well as a thriving black market for those who can afford to pay for faster or better service.
It's a reminder that there's no such thing as a truly free healthcare system. Someone always has to pay.
That's a fundamental principle in economics, and it applies to healthcare just as much as it does to any other good or service.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We were just talking about moral hazard and how it can impact healthcare costs. But what about the other side of the coin? What about the costs faced by doctors and hospitals? I imagine things like lawsuits must have a huge impact.
They absolutely do. The fear of being sued for malpractice is a major concern for medical professionals, and it can significantly impact the way they practice medicine.
So it's not just about providing the best possible care for patients. Doctors also have to protect themselves from potential legal trouble.
Exactly. It's a constant balancing act, and it can lead to what's called defensive medicine, where doctors order extra tests, procedures, or consultations, even if they're not strictly necessary from a medical standpoint.
So they're essentially covering their bases, just in case something goes wrong and a patient decides to sue.
Precisely. They want to be able to show that they did everything possible, even if it means going above and beyond what's considered standard medical practice.
But wouldn't that lead to a lot of unnecessary spending and potentially even expose patients to unnecessary risks?
It can, and it's a major contributor to rising healthcare costs. One area where this is particularly evident is in childbirth.
Childbirth. But that's supposed to be a natural process.
It is. But the fear of being sued for complications during childbirth has led to a dramatic increase in the number of cesarean sections performed.
So doctors are opting for C-sections even when they're not medically necessary, just to reduce their own legal risk.
That's a major factor, yes. C-sections are seen as a less risky procedure from a legal standpoint, even though they come with their own set of risks and complications for both the mother and the baby.
It's incredible how fear of lawsuits can distort medical decision-making in such a profound way. Let's shift gears a bit and talk about another major driver of healthcare costs, the development of new drugs. It seems like every time I turn on the TV, there's a new ad for some miracle drug, and they never seem cheap.
You're right. Pharmaceutical drugs can be incredibly expensive. And a big part of that cost is due to the enormous expense of developing new drugs and bringing them to market.
So what goes into developing a new drug? It's not like just whipping up a new recipe in the kitchen, right?
Not even close. It's an incredibly complex and lengthy process that involves years of research, clinical trials, and regulatory hurdles. It can easily cost hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars to bring a new drug to market.
Wow, that's a staggering amount of money. I guess that's why drug companies charge such high prices for their products. They need to recoup their investments and make a profit.
Exactly. It's a high-risk, high-reward business. Not every drug that enters development will make it to market. Many fail during clinical trials or are rejected by regulatory agencies like the FDA, so the companies that do succeed need to charge high enough prices to cover their losses on the drugs that don't pan out.
It's fascinating to see how economics plays such a crucial role in something as vital as healthcare. It's not just about science and medicine. It's also about incentives risk and the cost of innovation.
It absolutely is. And it's important to understand these economic factors if we want to create a healthcare system that is both innovative and affordable.
Well said. Now let's tackle another complex issue. Discrimination. It's a topic that is both emotionally charged and economically relevant. How does economics help us understand and address the problem of discrimination?
Discrimination is a multifaceted issue, and economics can provide valuable insights into its causes and consequences.
So it's not just about morality and fairness. There's an economic angle to discrimination as well.
Absolutely. It's important to remember that discrimination from an economic perspective is essentially about making choices that are not based on objective criteria like merit or productivity.
So, for example, if an employer refuses to hire someone based on their race or gender, that's a form of economic discrimination.
Exactly. And that type of discrimination can have real economic costs both for the individuals who are discriminated against and for society as a whole.
So how does economics help us address this problem?
One way is by understanding the role of competition. In a competitive market, businesses that discriminate are putting themselves at a disadvantage.
Because they're limiting their pool of potential talent.
Precisely. If a company refuses to hire qualified people simply because of their race, gender, or religion, they're missing out on talented individuals who could help their business thrive. And in a competitive market, that can be a fatal mistake.
So in a sense, competition can act as a force against discrimination.
It can, but it's not always enough on its own. Sometimes you need laws and regulations to level the playing field and ensure equal opportunity for everyone.
That makes sense. But even with laws against discrimination, it can still be difficult to measure its impact and determine if certain groups are truly disadvantaged.
That's true. And that's where economic analysis can be particularly helpful. Economists use statistical tools to try to isolate the effects of discrimination and control for other factors that might be contributing to disparities.
So they can look at things like income employment rates and educational attainment and see if there are significant differences between different groups, even after accounting for things like age, experience, and education.
Exactly. And this type of analysis can provide valuable evidence to support policies aimed at reducing discrimination and promoting equality.
It's fascinating to see how economics can be applied to such a wide range of social issues. It's a powerful lens for understanding the world around us.
It is, and it reminds us that everything is interconnected, and that even decisions that seem purely economic can have far-reaching social and political implications.
Well said. And I think that's a great place to wrap up our deep dive into the world of economics and politics. It's been an incredible journey exploring how these two forces shape our lives in countless ways.
It has been a fascinating exploration. We've seen how economic principles can shed light on everything from energy crises to healthcare costs to the complexities of discrimination.
It's a reminder that even seemingly simple decisions can have unintended consequences, and that it's always worth taking a step back to consider the bigger picture.
Absolutely. The more we understand about economics, the better equipped we are to make informed decisions that benefit both ourselves and society as a whole.
Well said. Thanks for joining us on The Deep Dive. And as always, keep those brains engaged and stay curious.